Welcome to our Fanhouse MMA podcast. This is Michael David Smith. And once again, I am very happy to be joined by Ariel Helwani of Versus.com. And now I can also just say Ariel Helwani of Fanhouse.com as well. Ariel, welcome. Thank you for joining me. And how are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here again, MDS. Very, very exciting and bizarre weekend that just passed us. So definitely lots to talk about on this episode 2.
Yeah, no doubt about it, and it's a situation where you were there in the arena, I was at home watching the pay-per-view broadcast. I'll tell you some of my thoughts on the broadcast of it, but the first thing I want to hear from you is just what did you think of the atmosphere in Montreal, and what are your overall thoughts looking back on Saturday night?
Well, as we firmly established last weekend, I am a very proud Montrealer, so it was very exciting for me to cover a MMA event, let alone a huge UFC event in my hometown. And I have to say, I mean, you know, biases aside, I think that the Canadian crowd, because I'm really not going to call this a Montreal crowd. We all know that, you know, people all the way from British Columbia and Nova Scotia come to these Montreal events now. I think that they're the best in MMA, and Dana White said it many times over the weekend. This is the mecca for mixed martial arts, Canada, that is, and I think they proved it on Saturday night. They were cheering. I mean, you should have heard in the undercards how they were cheering every single Canadian that came out, and there were a lot of them, seven in all on the entire card. And it's unfortunate at the end of the day that things had to turn out the way they did, because it was amazing. You know that famous Teenage Wasteland clip that they played before the pay-per-view starts? Every time Anderson Silva's face was shown on that clip, the fans were going nuts. They loved Anderson Silva, and by the end of the night, they were booing him, and come fourth round, they were leaving, which I'd never seen before. Fans who paid hundreds of dollars to watch a main event were leaving before the fight was over. So it's unfortunate the way things turned out, but overall, you have to look back on a very successful second venture into Canada for the UFC.
Yeah, and my own perceptions of watching from home on pay-per-view were pretty similar to yours, I think. The crowd was obviously very into it. You know, they as they so often do, they started the telecast by taking sort of a long panoramic shot of the arena, and it was an impressive sight. I mean, it was a noticeably larger crowd, and I believe this was their all-time attendance record, more than 21,000. So it was a huge crowd. It was obviously a very loud crowd. And I also agree with you that it's very unfortunate that it ended with Anderson Silva getting booed after winning in the main event. You just don't see that. I also saw what you mentioned. I could see in the background while watching on TV a couple people getting up and walking out, like, you know, they wanted to beat traffic more than they wanted to see the fifth round of a title fight, which is just something you never see in MMA. You see it in other sports, people leaving early. I had never seen it before in MMA before, and it's sad to see in what should have been a great thing, the fifth round of a title fight. Fifth rounds are exciting. You and I, a couple weeks ago, were privileged to be there to see a fifth round between Miguel Torres and Takeo Mizugaki. I assure you, nobody was leaving in the fifth round of that fight, but in Silva versus Leite, people were. And, you know, I think that's really where we need to start talking about UFC 97 is, where does Anderson Silva go from here, and how badly do you think his reputation has been tarnished?
I think his reputation has been tarnished on many levels. I think we need to make mention of how Dana White dealt with this situation at the post-fight press conference. He gets a lot of flack from a lot of people, and sometimes deservedly so, absolutely. But, you know, it was so refreshing to hear a promoter, because that's really what he is, be so open about how disappointed he was in Anderson Silva's performance.
Yeah, you are so right about that. And, you know, I was reminded of Gary Shaw. I interviewed Gary Shaw after the Kimbo Slice James Thompson fight now almost a year ago. And Gary Shaw was just going on and on about how dominant Kimbo was and how, you know, the referee had saved James Thompson because Kimbo, if he landed one more punch, would have just knocked James Thompson senseless, when we all knew that, you know, we hadn't seen a very good MMA display in that fight. This fight, you know, you talked to Dana White there afterward. What were his comments, and how disappointed did he seem?
He seemed very disappointed. I mean, he said he was never more embarrassed of a UFC main event like he was on Saturday night, and he was embarrassed by both men's performance, Anderson Silva and Talis Laitis. He said that he never wanted to not come to a press conference as much as he didn't want to come on Saturday night. I mean, that's pretty candid stuff. I mean, he did not sugarcoat this at all. He didn't try to sugarcoat Chuck Liddell's loss. He said Chuck Liddell's finished, he's done. I mean, you know, any promoter can make a case that, hey, Chuck Liddell lost to Shogun, Rashad Evans, and Quinn Jackson. You could do a lot worse than that, but he says he's done. He doesn't want to see him fight, and he doesn't want to see him lose anymore. Dana White was very open. He was, you know, someone even asked him after the press conference when a couple of reporters were surrounding him and said it almost seemed as though Anderson Silva was trying to punish everyone else for the way Talis Laitis was fighting, and he was not going to want to engage with him just to show that, you know, he's better than all this. And Dana agreed. Dana said that he could not figure out what's going on in Anderson Silva's mind. He thought that, you know, all that nonsense was over and done with after what happened and the flack that Anderson Silva received in Chicago after UFC 90, and now he's just scratching his head. And I think that, you know, the main thing, really, I truly believe this, there's something serious going on behind the scenes between the UFC and Anderson Silva. In the pre-fight press conference on Thursday, Dana White was trying to hype up, you know, the return of the real Anderson Silva, saying that, you know, he looked human for the first time at UFC 90 against Patrick Cote. And by the way, Anderson Silva understands English 100%, because I was looking at him while Dana was talking. Ed Suarez, his manager / translator, didn't even have to translate for him in his ear, and he was making faces at Dana, shaking his head, shrugging off everything he had to say about him looking human. And he was doing the same thing on Saturday night, just, you know, sitting there like a kid who wasn't happy with what his parents were doing to him, and was just going to mope and sit there and give very bizarre answers to the media and almost play off this thing like, you guys just don't understand me, so I'm not going to bother. So it's a very interesting time right now for the UFC and Anderson Silva, and I think they need to square this away right away, because the only people that are suffering in the end are the fans.
Yeah, and I do worry that there's a chance that the backlash against Anderson Silva is going to go too far. I mean, the guy is still 9-0 in the octagon, but his worst two fights are his most recent two. The Patrick Cote fight, and now his very worst fight is the Talis Laitis fight. And I also think Talis Laitis needs to get a fair amount of the blame. I counted up the number of times that he was stood up by referee Levine, and I counted 14. I actually then heard from a reader who told me on this one it was actually 15. But whatever it is, I don't ever recall seeing a guy get stood up that many times. I think Eve Levine even deserves some of the blame. I think that he at least should have warned Talis Laitis. There was one that I thought was so flagrant, I would have liked to see a referee take a point away, because, you know, there is a rule. It clearly states in the rules. If you look at the rules of North American MMA, one of the fouls is timidity or avoiding contact with your opponent. And Talis Laitis was doing that to such an extent, especially in the third and the fifth round, that I do think he deserves quite a bit of the blame. But, you know, I think that you and I and most MMA fans, we probably just want to put Talis Laitis behind us, forget all about him, and really focus on Anderson Silva. Because Talis Laitis, you know, he'll be on the undercard in some show in this fall probably, and, you know, he'll be fighting a so-so middleweight in a fight that people won't make that big a deal about. But the bottom line is, Anderson Silva is still the middleweight champion. He's still the guy that some people think is the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world. We need to see him get a good challenge, someone who brings out the Anderson Silva that we saw against Rich Franklin, the Anderson Silva we saw against Dan Henderson, the Anderson Silva we saw against James Irvin, because when Anderson Silva beat James Irvin on Spike in a very well-received fight, a fight that got a lot of viewers on Spike last summer, I thought, okay, now Anderson Silva is becoming a star. That's the type of fight before a big audience that makes a guy a star. Since then, he's had his two worst performances in the octagon. And I don't know, Ariel, do you think that there's anything the UFC can do to motivate him? And when and against whom do you think we're going to see Anderson Silva again?
I think there are many things that the UFC could do to motivate him. I think it's time, and I've said this many times in the past, I did not want to see Anderson Silva leave the middleweight division. I did not want to see him, you know, vacate the title and move up. But it's time to make that happen, if only because he's begging for it. Dana White said, again, in the post-fight press conference, if he's looking for a challenge, they've got a lot of challenges for him waiting at 205. And if that's what he wants, I think the UFC should give it to him. And it's almost like you got to fight fire with fire here. This kid, you know, he's like a little kid, the way he's acting, and he's trying to punish everyone for booking him against these guys who he doesn't think are worthy enough of being in the octagon with him. So let's see if he feels the same way when he's up against Quentin Jackson or Shogun Hua. Personally, before we get to that, I want to see him go up against GSP. If GSP gets by Thiago Alves, I think that's the fight that makes most sense. When do you ever get a chance to put the number two and number three best pound-for-pound fighters in the world? And by the way, number two is without a doubt 100% George St. Pierre. It is not Anderson Silva. And I'm starting to think about dropping Anderson Silva down to maybe four or five. I'm very disappointed in him. I think right now you have to say that Anderson Silva is an overrated fighter who doesn't deserve any of the praise that he's been receiving, beating Talis Latis, Patrick Cote, and James Irvin, whoop-de-doo. I mean, if you're the type of fighter that is going to get up and down for certain fights, you do not deserve to be called the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world. I'm sorry. It's just totally inexcusable.
Now, there's an interesting issue. There are a couple interesting things. First of all, the pound-for-pound list, pound-for-pound rankings are more for fun conversation than they are really meaningful, important discussions. But you're right that GSP versus Anderson Silva would be two guys who are very close to the top. And you're also right that I don't think too many people are going to call Anderson Silva number one anymore. You know, Yahoo does a poll that I vote in where they have the top 10 pound for pound. And in the last couple, it's actually been a tie. Fedor Emelianenko and Anderson Silva first. I am certain it won't be a tie anymore, much to Dana White's chagrin. Fedor Emelianenko will be all alone at number one, I'm sure, whenever they do the next poll. Because at least, you know, I'm one of the voters, and I can tell you I'm going to drop Anderson Silva. I had him second before. I'm going to drop him at least to third behind George St. Pierre, maybe also to fourth behind Miguel Torres. I haven't made up my mind about that. But no question about it, Anderson Silva does drop. I love the idea of Anderson Silva versus George St. Pierre. I've been saying for about a year now that I'd love to see that fight. But one question that I have is, does the UFC want Anderson Silva to be waiting around that long? Because George St. Pierre has a very tough challenge at UFC 100 against Thiago Alves. Does the UFC really want to put Anderson Silva on mothballs for quite a while before George St. Pierre has that fight, then let George St. Pierre take the time that he would want, because we know what kind of athlete George St. Pierre is. He's the type of athlete who wants to prepare the right way. He would want to take the time to bulk up his body to get up to 185 pounds. That would be a long time. We're talking maybe it would be the last show of 2009, or it would be early 2010. Does the UFC really want to wait that long before Anderson Silva fights again? Or does the UFC want to say, we need to get him back out there and get him against somebody who's going to force him to fight hard and really challenge him, someone who's going to be throwing down with him, so that Anderson Silva can kind of wash out the bad taste that was left in a lot of fans' mouths?
Yeah, and that's the real problem with the George St. Pierre fight, and that's actually why I don't think it's going to happen. In a perfect world, I would love to see it happen, but I truly believe that we're going to see Anderson Silva get tested in a big way in his next fight, and I have a feeling deep down it's going to be against Quentin Jackson. I think this fight makes absolute sense. Jackson last fought in March. He's rehabbing a little. He had a few injuries coming out of the Keith Jardine fight, and here we have a month and a half later or so, Anderson Silva fights. You have them fight sometime later this summer or early fall, depending on when they're both ready. And you know what? Winner of that fight gets a shot at the title. And trust me, you got Lyoto Machida, you got Rashad Evans, Quentin Jackson. Anderson Silva is going to feel tested by every single one of those, and I think it will bring back the Anderson Silva of old. So that's what I would do, and you know, bring in Quinn and Jackson and let them go at him guns blazing. We'll see how much Anderson Silva will be dancing. And I don't want to come off like an Anderson Silva hater. You know, I'm a huge fan of his. I think what he's done in the UFC is nothing short of remarkable. But the way he's been acting, pre-fight press conference, post-fight press conference, in the cage, during the fights, it's not the way a champion should act, and it's not the way a guy who we've been told is the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world should act. And it's time, if he's begging for a challenge, it's time to give him a challenge. So I hope the UFC will come through, and I'm actually very, very confident that they will, because Dana White was personally embarrassed, and he was almost offended, and he even said it in his video blog. It's not like he's making this up in front of the reporters. I think that, for lack of a better term, he's going to look to punish Anderson Silva, and I'm not saying that in a negative way, but he's going to say, listen, you've done this to us twice in two very big markets, two very important markets, Chicago and Montreal. You're not going to do this to us again, and like you mentioned yesterday, it's unfortunate that Damian Maia is probably not going to get his title shot. No one has told me this, or I doubt anyone's told you this, but I can't see them putting him up against a guy like Maia after what went down this weekend.
No, no one has told me that specifically, but I feel very confident saying Anderson Silva's next fight will not be Damian Maia. They just need it. All due respect to Damian Maia, I like Damian Maia. I would have rather seen Damian Maia in the cage against Silva Saturday night than Talos Leites, but it's just not, they need a sexier matchup for Anderson Silva, and they need a striker who's going to push the pace against Anderson Silva if Anderson Silva won't push the pace on his own. So that's just not, that fight just isn't going to happen. I think the UFC was sort of tentatively viewing Anderson Silva. He beats Talos Leites, and then I think UFC 102 at the end of August was kind of what they were penciling him in for next. You mentioned Rampage Jackson. Believe me, I would love Anderson Silva versus Rampage Jackson. I mean, that could be an all-time great fight, but I actually don't see that happening. I think that Rampage Jackson probably won't fight again until the Rashad Evans, Lyoto Machida winner is ready to defend that title, and then I think Rampage Jackson gets that title shot. I love the idea of Shogun Hua against Anderson Silva at 205 pounds. You know, I'm not sure who else at 205 pounds. Anderson Silva, when he's on his game, I think beats anyone at 205 pounds. I mean, when he's at his best, that's how impressive he is. So it has to be someone good. It has to be one of the elite light heavyweights. It can't be a guy like a James Irvin, who's kind of that, you know, below that top 10 level. It needs to be a top 10 light heavyweight. I would hope a top 5 light heavyweight. But based on timing, I really think the guy who makes the most sense from a scheduling perspective is Shogun Hua. That's a fight that I would love to see. It's a fight that I think, based on the way Anderson Silva has fought the last two times, though, it wouldn't be a fight that would sell pay-per-views on his own. I think it would have to be paired with a big fight like Couture versus Nogueira, and the truth is more people would be buying the pay-per-view for Couture versus Nogueira. But, you know, Anderson Silva,
Here's why I don't want to see Shogun. Sorry to cut you off, is because I think that you need a guy like Rampage Jackson who's going to talk trash and get that fire lit underneath him. I think that you need, you know, Shogun. He's going to be very respectful, and you know, they're both Brazilian, and Anderson said it's unfortunate that I have to fight a Brazilian on Saturday. On Thursday he said this, so I think you need a guy like Quinn Jackson who, you know, talks trash better than anyone in MMA to really go out there and you know, start, you know, throwing some bombs towards Anderson Silva, and I think he'd be down for this. You know, we all know his relationship with Dana White, and I'm not trying to make this into like a Dana White versus Anderson Silva thing, but I could totally see them going up to Quinn and say, you know, let's see what this guy's made of, because right now he's asking for it, and I just don't see the fans getting behind. The fans love Quinn Jackson, and right now Anderson Silva has turned himself into a heel. I mean, he's a lot of people are against Anderson Silva right now, and a lot of people love Quinn Jackson. So I could see, you know, I could see an interesting babyface versus heel matchup, to steal a pro wrestling term, and have Quinn Jackson go in there guns blazing. So I think that would be a great main event too, because Anderson Silva has proven that he's not exactly, you know, the pay-per-view draw that he should be. Quinn Jackson certainly is, regardless of what happened at UFC 96. I mean, he was paired up against a guy a lot of fans just don't really have an emotional investment towards, in Keith Jardine. But I think that matchup would do wonders. And right now, the UFC is definitely delivering in terms of their matchups. I think they would do very well in booking this one.
Yeah, and believe me, I love Rampage Jackson versus Anderson Silva. I mean, that would be just a tremendous fight. It might be the best light heavyweight fight that they could put on. It may very well be a better light heavyweight fight than Rashad Evans versus Lyoto Machida. But I think it's a little bit unfair to Rampage Jackson to tell him you're not getting a title shot until you get through Anderson Silva. I mean, Rampage Jackson, I feel like he has earned that next title shot. Personally, on my scorecard, he beat Forrest Griffin. So I feel like he really should still be the champion. But when you look at the totality of everything that Rampage Jackson has done in the octagon, I thought he certainly deserved a title shot after Wanderlei Silva. Then he beats Keith Jardine. He really deserves a title shot now. Now he has to get through yet another opponent before he gets that title shot. That's my biggest objection there. Do you think that maybe they just need to say that Rampage Jackson is getting the next title shot and that Anderson Silva has to fall in line in the 205-pound class?
Well, the problem is that, you know, things change. And the fact of the matter is that Quinn Jackson was offered a title shot and he couldn't do it. And it's the same way that, you know, Kyle Parisian was once offered a title shot and wasn't able to perform, and Yushin Okami was offered a title shot and got injured. And this is a very similar situation. Now, obviously, they offered him that title shot, you know, moments after his last victory. But still, you know, things change and things evolve in every weight class. And right now, this is a dilemma that the UFC is facing. And I think that this is the best way, if you're not going to book the GSP matchup, it's the best way to take care of that dilemma. And, you know, I agree with you. I had Quinn Jackson winning that fight against Forrest Griffin last year in July. I thought that, you know, he performed brilliantly against Wanderlei Silva. Not that great against Keith Jardine. I thought he could have finished him a little earlier. But, you know, here we are. May 23rd is still almost a month and change away. Then you're going to have to wait a long time for Rashad or Lyoto Machida to get ready again. It's, you know, a lot of things change. So I think you gotta play with the cards you're dealt with right now. And you can't book Anderson Silva in another middleweight fight now. I just don't see how the fans would respond to that unless you sign someone like Robbie Lawler tomorrow. So if you look at the landscape at 205... I just think that that's the fight that makes the most sense.
Yeah, and I think you're right. You know, Robbie Lawler, obviously that wouldn't happen. I also, frankly, I don't give Robbie Lawler much of a prayer of beating Anderson Silva at 185, although he might at least make it more interesting than Talos Latis or Patrick Cote did. I am glad. I do want to just say a quick I told you so, because last week I said time for Anderson Silva to fight at 205. You disagreed. I'm glad you've come around on it there.
Absolutely.
But you know, the question remains, what happens with the 185-pound belt? I mean, does Anderson Silva make a permanent move up to 205? Does he make a temporary move and then maybe come back down to 185 to fight George St. Pierre? I mean, it does get a little bit weird with these guys moving weight classes while they own a belt. I didn't like the BJ Penn, obviously. Like all MMA fans, I was excited about the BJ Penn George St. Pierre fight, but I didn't like what that did to the lightweight division, and I worry that we could be setting up more problems if we're saying, well, Anderson Silva is going to go back up to 205, come down to 185, where, by the way, now George St. Pierre is going to be fighting, putting the 170 belt on hold. Do we get to a point where we need guys to just declare a weight class and fight in it so that we avoid this problem that boxing has had where you ask a fan to name the boxing weight classes and who is the champion of them, and they have no idea. Is that a problem? And do we need Anderson Silva maybe even to just vacate the middleweight belt and move up to 205 permanently.
Yeah, it is a big problem. And anyone who's, you know, anyone's heard me talk about this in the past knows that I like clean cut weight classes. I don't like guys moving up and down. I didn't like BJ moving up to fight George St. Pierre. However, like I said, I think this is a very, very special situation. And right now, I would not be against the UFC, you know, putting Anderson Silva up in the 205-pound division and just having a bunch of guys fight in the middleweight division to determine a clear-cut number one contender, because as good as Damian Maia has been performing as of late, I really don't think that he's a true number one contender, the same way I don't think Talis Laitis was a number one contender, the same way I don't think Patrick Cote was a number one contender. I believe that Yushin Okami is the one number one contender. Clearly, the UFC disagrees with me. He has a pretty interesting fight coming up at UFC 98 against Dan Miller. So let a bunch of these guys fight. Let them kind of, you know, figure it out for themselves. And when they're ready, Anderson Silva will come back down. There's no, you know, there's no rule anywhere that says the champion has to keep defending his belt. I mean, obviously he has to do so in a year, but if he's ready to fight and there are no clear contenders, make fights that fight fans want. And fight fans don't want to see Anderson Silva fighting against guys who they don't view as number one contender. All the champions in all the other weight classes in the UFC are getting tested every single time out. George St. Pierre gets tested every single time out. BJ Penn is about to get tested in a big way. Brock Lesnar is getting tested. Rashad Evans is getting tested. Anderson Silva isn't getting tested and is acting like a baby because of it. So just let those guys figure it out. He goes up. When they're ready, he'll come back down. That's the best way. I would hate to see him vacate the title, because then I feel like it just kind of, you know, devalues the title, and I would hate to see that happen. So that's the way I would go about it.
Yeah, and I think those are good points. I think it's questionable how they're going to set up who that next middleweight contender is. You and I are in agreement about Yushin Okami. I actually am frankly kind of amazed that Yushin Okami still doesn't even seem to be close to title contention, the way the UFC is not really promoting him at all. His last fight didn't even make the TV broadcast. I thought Yushin Okami would have been a good challenge for Anderson Silva. People have said he's a boring fighter. I don't really agree with that, and I don't think it would have been any more boring than what we saw Saturday night. But I also think the UFC, they're a little bit concerned about things like setting up two guys as a number one contender battle. They did it with Patrick Cote and Ricardo Almeida, and I think they feel a little bit burned by that, because that wasn't, first of all, that wasn't that exciting a fight in and of itself. Cote wins a split decision over Almeida. It wasn't a great fight. And then the next fight, Cote gets Anderson Silva, and that's not a great fight. So I think the UFC might be a little bit worried that if we move Anderson Silva up and we declare, okay, you know, whatever it would be, Marquardt versus Maia, maybe that this is for number one contender status, and they turn out not to have a good fight, that could create its own mess. But I like your line of thinking overall, that they just need to do something to get Anderson Silva back to the Anderson Silva of old. I don't know if we want to spend this entire podcast talking about Anderson Silva. We
it's
obviously
depressing.
Both have strong opinions. Go ahead, Ariel.
No, I said it was depressing.
It is. You're absolutely right. It's too bad that this is what we're talking about, because I still think Anderson Silva is a great fighter, and I still think he's got exciting fights ahead of him. It's just depressing that we didn't see one Saturday night, and we're not sure how it is that we're going to see one again sometime soon. But a guy who has given us a lot of exciting fights through the years, maybe more exciting fights through the years than anyone in the history of the UFC, of course, is Chuck Liddell. Have we seen him in the octagon for the last time?
Yeah, I think so. Dana White said it himself, and Chuck, while he didn't, you know, clear-cut say it on Saturday night, it did seem as though he was leaning towards retiring from the octagon. And the one thing about combat sports that you and I both know, in a year from now, it's going to be interesting if Chuck Liddell is sitting on the sidelines and starts to get antsy. Is he going to want to come back? And it's a very interesting dilemma, because the UFC is basically going to have to pay him not to go anywhere else, because they've said, we don't want to promote your fights anymore. I know there's a lot of people out there that would love to throw boatloads of money his way. UFC is going to have to make it very interesting for him not to stick around, because even in the pre-fight press conferences, people asked him, you know, if Dana White doesn't want to promote your fights, what are you going to do if you still want to fight? And he said, you know, we'll cross that bridge when I get to it. But this guy on Thursday and Friday did not look like a guy who was ready to hang it up, win or lose. Even talking to John Hackelman, his manager slash trainer, he said, we'll go as long as Chuck wants to go, even if he keeps losing. If he wants to keep fighting, he's earned the right to keep fighting. So, you know, Dana White said it on behalf of Chuck, but, as we all know, fighters often have plans of their own. Personally, I think it will be the last time we see him in the UFC. I don't know if it's the last time we'll ever see him in an MMA cage. I just think that expect the unexpected when you talk about these fighters. But let me just say that, you know, I was very happy to see Chuck finish his career, if it was his final fight in the UFC, in Montreal, just because, and I've been to a lot of great sporting events in Montreal. They treat legends better than any sports fans that I've seen. And I'm not just saying this because I'm there. I've seen them give 10-minute standing ovations to Hulk Hogan and Maurice Richard. They just love giving standing ovations, and they really, really did a nice thing by cheering Chuck after he lost to Shogun, and I think it touched him. As he was walking out of the cage, waving to the crowd, you couldn't even hear his conversation with Joe Rogan. So if it was the last time we saw him in the octagon, it's unfortunate. But do I want to see him again? Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think he is done in the UFC. I think you make a very good point that it could get a little dicey if he insists, I want to come back, and the UFC insists, we don't want you to fight again. Can they stop him? I mean, if it really comes to that, and I hope it doesn't, but I don't know if they can stop him. I think that it could turn into a mess, somewhat like Randy Couture versus the UFC turned into a mess, although that was a different kind of mess altogether. In fairness to Chuck, you look at his last five opponents: Shogun Rua, Rashad Evans, Wanderlei Silva, Keith Jardine, and Rampage Jackson. There are a lot of guys who'd be 1-4 against that five, and there are guys in the UFC who would be 0-5 against that five. So it's not like Chuck is just horrible. It's not like Chuck is absolutely a terrible mixed martial artist now. It's just that he's not one of the elite anymore, and you and I don't want to see Chuck Liddell when he's not in the elite anymore, and Dana White doesn't want to see Chuck Liddell when he's not in the elite anymore. But I don't know. I think Chuck Liddell might think to himself, even if I'm not one of the 10 best anymore, if I'm one of the 25 best, I want to keep trying. I want to keep going out there and fight a guy. If I'm number 25, I want to fight a guy who's number 20 and prove I can beat him. I think that's the mindset of a competitor, and it's going to be hard for the UFC to convince him not to fight again, but I think they'll try really hard, and I feel like Dana White and the Fertittas feel pretty comfortable saying, you're not going to step back in the octagon.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Like you mentioned, he's fought some really tough guys, and there's no shame in losing to them. The problem is, the Chuck of old would have beaten most of them. So, trust me, I think that if you put Chuck in there with a guy like James Irvin, I think he would probably win at this point. Before getting caught, he still looked good. I thought he won that first round against Rashad Evans, but you know, he clearly can hang with the top 10, top 15 light heavyweights in the world. And Dana White and Chuck have a long history together. And I think that he just doesn't want to promote fights that he thinks Chuck Liddell is going to win. I think when Dana White promotes fights, he might not have thought that Tos Latis had a chance to win on Saturday, but I don't think he wants to, you know, throw him out there and make him look like Muhammad Ali did in his final days in boxing in the early 80s. So, and Chuck Liddell, in my opinion, is the Muhammad Ali of MMA. He put this sport on the map probably more so than anyone, just because he didn't look like, you know, every boxer out there. He had a unique style. He fought in a unique way, and he had this star quality about him. Everyone knows Chuck Liddell because of the mohawk and the head tattoos and all that. And he's just a great ambassador for the sport, and I think that's what the UFC wants to use him as. They want to, you know, put him out there, you know, in front of the New York State Assembly and have him talk about why MMA is a good sport and why it should be legalized in New York, and have him go over to Iraq or Afghanistan and meet the troops. There's definitely a place for Chuck Liddell in doing that, but I don't know if he's ready to do that. That's the problem. So it's going to be interesting. I definitely don't see him, you know, fighting in a year or even two. But, you know, I wouldn't put it past him in a year and a half or 2 years to say, hey, I want to come back. And the big question is, and one that I wish I asked, is what's Chuck's contract? Because, you know, if his contract expired after this fight, the UFC can't pull what they did with Randy Couture. He could pretty much say, you know, thanks for that offer, I'm going to think about it, and then go sign somewhere else. I don't think he would be that sneaky with Dana White, but it'll be a lot easier for him to do so than it was for someone like, say, Randy Couture.
Yeah, and Ariel, I would go a little bit further than you are. If Chuck Liddell really wants to fight, even if his contract, no matter what his contract status is, as I understand contractual law, you really can't keep a person from making a living. I mean, if they have a contract to Chuck Liddell, and Chuck Liddell sues them and says, wait a minute, you're holding me to this contract, but you're not giving me the fights that the contract says I'm supposed to be fighting for your organization, I think, and I'm not a lawyer, but I believe Chuck Liddell ultimately would win a case like that, because you cannot prevent a guy from making a living. You can say, we're not going to pay you anymore, but you can't say, we're not going to let you go somewhere else to make a living indefinitely. I mean, there's a term of the contract, and while he's under that contract, they can prevent him from going to, you know, Affliction or Strikeforce or whoever. But eventually, they can't stop him. And I think, I hope that the relationship is strong enough that it would never come to that it's never going to be Chuck Liddell hires a lawyer and the UFC hires a lawyer and they spend a long time in court, and at the end, Chuck Liddell wins his free agency. And I also hope that it's not Chuck Liddell hires a lawyer who forces the UFC to say, well, okay, we can't stop you, we are going to put you back in. And, you know, they put him in with the John Joneses of the world, the young up-and-comers, and those guys start beating up Chuck Liddell. That would be a pretty ugly situation. I hope it doesn't come to that. And I don't think it's going to come to that, because I think the UFC has a good enough relationship with Chuck that it won't come to that. But I think only the athletic commissions could really stop him. It would only be if the athletic commission says he can't even pass a physical. And I don't think Chuck's at that level yet, by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's the only way they can really just keep him from fighting anywhere, anytime. So that would be a bad situation for everyone, for Chuck, for the UFC, for the sport. And I hope it doesn't come to that.
Yeah, I hope so as well. But it's very weird, because it's like, you didn't hear Roger Goodell saying, okay, Brett Favre is done. You know what I mean? We've never heard.
Right.
And I know Dana White is not exactly your typical commissioner, and his roles are a little different because he actually owns the league. But, you know, we didn't hear Chuck say this was it. And that's the part that I find to be a little strange. But, you know, I think it's, you know, obviously Chuck Liddell deserves all the amount of attention in the world, but I think we definitely should mention how great Mauricio Shogun Hua looked, because everyone was pretty much writing this guy off, a guy who at one point he was like the second best light heavyweight, maybe even the best light heavyweight in the world, looked pretty bad in his first two UFC fights, losing the first one to Forrest Griffin, the second one defeating Mark Coleman, but looked like he ran out of gas very early in the fight, and really should have beat Mark Coleman a lot earlier. At the weigh-ins, he looked great. He looked great on Saturday night, and he took Chuck's best shot and gave it right back to him and was able to finish him. I think he did hit him twice in the back of the head when he threw down those seven hammer fists, but I think by then it was pretty much a moot point. Shogun is a very nice piece to add to this ever-evolving light heavyweight division, and I think he's one or two fights away from saying, you know, I deserve a title shot too. So it's good to see him back, and it's good for UFC fans to see the Shogun that we all know, the people who cover this sport from back in the Pride days. Perhaps he's not there just yet, but it's a very encouraging sign to see.
Yeah, and keep in mind, Shogun's 27 years old. This isn't a guy who's Chuck Liddell's age who looked bad for a while. This is a guy in his 20s who had knee problems. I would compare him to an NFL running back who misses a season with an ACL tear. You're going to be concerned about that running back, certainly, and you might say he's never going to be, if this running back, to extend the analogy, had been the rookie of the year at one point, you might think, boy, will he ever come back to that level? But if he's still in his 20s, you have to think that he's got time to get to that level, and I think he would be a dangerous opponent. I'd love to see him get a rematch with Forrest Griffin if he's 100%, and Forrest Griffin is 100% at some point. That'd be a fun fight. I'd love to see a rematch between Rampage and Shogun. They had a fight that Shogun won in Pride. I'd love to see those two at it again. I think you're right. I think one or two more wins puts Shogun Hua in title contention, and that's exciting. It's exciting to me to think about Shogun being back at or near the top of the light heavyweight division. It's been a long time coming. It was all of 2008 that he sat out, didn't look good at the end of 2007 or the start of 2009, and now finally he looks healthy again. He says he feels good again, and I think it's going to be very exciting to see what he does next. And that's one of the guys who I feel like we can feel good about coming out of there. Another one just to mention maybe quickly in the light heavyweight division is Luis Cain, who wasn't able to finish his fight, but again, looks like a very good striker. I think is one of the better strikers in the light heavyweight division, and is a guy I'm looking forward to seeing what he does next.
Yeah, and I think one of the more underrated fighters at 205 in MMA. I actually thought that was fight of the night. I thought both guys, Cain and Cantwell, put on a great fight, and definitely had Cain winning. And he continues to slowly climb the ladder. Looked very good defeating Sokoju at UFC 89. Looked very good on Saturday night, and it'll be interesting to see who they match him up against. The rumor was that he was going to fight Keith Jardine, and then Jardine then went on to face Quinn Jackson. I think he might have. I don't think he's passed Keith Jardine by, but maybe that's a matchup that they put together. Obviously, Keith's coming off of a loss, and I'd rather see Cain fight someone who's on a bit of a winning streak to see if he can continue as well. But I thought he did great. And I thought that, again, another guy in that 205-pound division that is now just, mixing it up. Like, for a second there, it was like, okay, where do we go from here in 205? It was so crowded, and then it kind of – it felt a little flat for just one moment. And I think now it's very exciting. The Evans-Machida fight is going to be amazing, and it's really – of all the fights this coming summer – it's really the one that I'm having a really hard time picking. I have no idea who's going to win that fight. And then after that, there's a litany of great choices on the horizon. So Cain looked great, and I know you're very excited about Czech Congo. Personally, I still don't think he's there in terms of getting a title shot, but I know you were very pleased with his performance.
I like Czech Congo a lot. I think he needs one more win over a better opponent than Anthony Hardonk. I mean, he basically did what I expected him to do. I think what you expected him to do against Anthony Hardonk, which is, do well enough in the stand-up against a guy who's a good kickboxer to get him to the ground and then beat him with ground and pound. So that's basically what we thought he would do. I would love to see him take on somebody like a Shane Carwin. I think the timing of that could work out pretty well. Shane Carwin, even though he beat Gabriel Gonzaga very quickly, he did have a broken nose. He wanted a little bit of time off. I think he's on the mend now, and I would like to see the two of them lock horns maybe this summer or fall. And then I could see if the winner, maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I think if the winner of the Congo Carwin fight looks good, I could see that person being declared the number one heavyweight contender in a heavyweight division that, as we said last week, is looking revitalized, especially compared to where it was just a short time ago.
Yeah, that's a good matchup because both of them, are huge heavyweights, and both of them can fight on the ground. I like that matchup a lot. Congo was supposed to fight. The rumor was that he was supposed to fight Brock Lesnar before Lesnar was eventually matched up against Randy Couture. So he was right there, and I think he would pose a very interesting problem for Lesnar. I just think that, you know, with now Carwin and Cain Velasquez and obviously Big Nog and Couture, he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And like you said, a victory over someone like Anthony Hardunk doesn't really put you in the mix, so to speak. But if they do match him up against Carwin and he defeats Carwin, then he's right back in there. So he's kind of just flying under the radar here. But other than that loss to Heath Herring, which really set him back, he's now back on track and should be stepping up in competition fairly soon.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, it showed, I thought it was the six fights that made the live TV broadcast. They kind of had a scheduling snafu that turned out to be pretty good because we got a pretty good extra fight on the live TV broadcast the way that the scheduling worked out. But I thought that all of those six fights kind of showed, gave a fairly good indication of where things stand in the UFC. You see some of the younger guys, you see some of the older guys, you see that Anderson Silva needs a much bigger challenge than the UFC is giving him. One thing that we didn't see, those of us who were watching at home, that I'm interested to hear you talk about a little bit, is the non-televised fights. None of the dark card ended up making the live pay-per-view card. I'm especially curious about Elliot Marshall against Vinny Magalhães. I know a lot of Ultimate Fighter viewers from last season were interested in that fight. I think it's a little disappointing that that fight wasn't televised because so many people were interested in it from the Ultimate Fighter. But just tell me, Frank Mir told me that Vinny Magalhães has the best Brazilian jiu-jitsu of any light heavyweight in the UFC. Is the answer to that just, so what? That it's not sport jiu-jitsu, it's MMA, and Vinny Magalhães just isn't good enough at MMA?
Well, exactly that, because if he does have the best jiu-jitsu, he certainly didn't try to show it on Saturday night. He is another case of a guy who is 100% better on the ground, and for one reason or another just decides to stand and trade with his opponent, who's a better striker than him, and that's what Vinny did on Saturday. And the funny thing was is that he took him down twice. One of the times it was like on a trip after catching a kick from Marshall, and he takes him down, is able to pass guard in a second, full mount, side control. I mean, it looked so effortless. And one time, I think it was at the end of the second round, Marshall was saved by the bell, but I think he could have almost finished him via ground and pound. I have no idea why Vinny didn't try to take him to the ground earlier, and I'm surprised that his camp didn't try to tell him to, you know, start taking this guy down. He didn't, and he looked horrible standing up, and I don't see how the UFC keeps him around. Sub-500 record. Like you said, his jiu-jitsu might be great, but big deal. Like, he's not doing anything to prove it. He was exposed against Bader, and he was exposed again on Saturday night. So, yeah, you didn't miss much. Don't worry about missing that fight.
And, of course, I missed all of the dark matches because, as I said, they didn't show any of them on the pay-per-view broadcast. Usually they do, but as we mentioned, they had that little scheduling issue. But overall, what were your perceptions of the dark matches? Any of them particularly stand out? And also, how into it was the crowd? Because I'm always interested in seeing, you know, boxing anymore. You go to a boxing match and the only thing people care about is the main event. How was the crowd for the dark matches, and how were the fights for the dark matches?
Well, it was a late arriving crowd, but once they did arrive, they were so loud, perhaps even louder than on the main card. I mean, like I said earlier, the undercard was filled with Canadians, and every time they announced a Canadian, whether it was a guy coming from Toronto or Nova Scotia or BC, the crowd, it almost felt like we were in that particular province because the crowd was went insane. And for the most part, they were you know, they left home pretty happy in terms of how they felt about their Canadians. Mark Bocek looked amazing, winning via rear naked choke in the first round. TJ Grant looked incredible, defeating Rio Chona, and I think he's going to be a big star in the UFC, as I mentioned last week. Unfortunately, a couple of Canadians didn't do that well, and particularly David the Crow Loazo, obviously Montreal boy, a big star in his day in the UFC. It started out pretty spectacular fashion because everyone knows Loazo for his spinning back kick that he, you know, which helped him defeat Charles McCarthy a few years back, and he opened with that kick, and the crowd went insane. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to see the return of the Crow. And then it was just a pathetic performance. I hate to say it, but he was slipping. He was falling. It was almost sad to watch. I don't see how David the Crow Loazo returns to the UFC. He can't promote his fight. It was very reminiscent of the way he fought Joey Villasenor, where he got another big chance and just crumbled under the pressure. So, you know, kudos to Ed Herman. He fought a good fight. Loazo didn't really put up much of a threat to him, but Ed Herman appears to have saved his job. And Jason McDonald looked really bad against Nate Quarry. And, you know, MMA Junkie had a report that he's going to be sticking around. But, I have not been impressed with Jason McDonald as of late. On the flip side, Nate Quarry looked very good. And finally, Dennis Kang, good to see him back in action and good to see him back on the winning side of things. Had a tough debut in the UFC, got caught against Alan Belcher, and you know he looks solid against Xavier Fupa-Pokam, or as Joe Rogan just called him, Professor X, throughout the weigh-ins, because it's a lot easier to say that. But Kang looked good, and again, a couple wins, maybe he's in the mix. I don't think he's there quite yet, but he definitely looked good on Saturday night.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you and others I've heard from say that Dennis Kang looked good, because I actually thought he looked very good in his UFC debut, right up until the moment that he just kind of lazily went in for a takedown and got caught in a guillotine. It's one of those things that you would think a fighter with his skill level and his experience level would have known how to avoid, but I thought he did look good in his UFC debut right up until the point that he got submitted. And I'm glad to hear that he looked good in the undercard. And I'm glad to hear that the Montreal fans were getting behind the Canadian fighters, because it does seem like a great fan base that just unfortunately with the main event kind of turned on it. I hope that fans in Montreal didn't turn on the UFC as a whole as they were booing the main event. It certainly didn't sound like they were, because they were also chanting GSP. So it didn't sound like a crowd that was thinking, we don't like the UFC anymore. It just sounded like a crowd that was thinking, we'd sure love to see GSP beat the crap out of Anderson Silva.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The biggest reaction in that main event went when they showed GSP on the big screen. Everyone was cheering for him, shouting his name, GSP, GSP. That's definitely who the Montreal fans want to see fight Anderson Silva. But like you said, as much as I want to see it happen too, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. And let's not, you know, disrespect Thiago Alves. This is a guy that can definitely beat GSP come July 11th. I wouldn't pick him, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happened. So there's a lot more chapters to be written in this story. And the main point is Anderson Silva needs to be tested. And again, for lack of a better term, he needs to be punished for this, because it's two fights in a row that he's pulled off these stinkers in fights that he could have finished them early. He could have fought in a lot more exciting fashion, and for whatever reason, chose not to. I think, again, it's an underlying issue between his camp and the UFC, and I just like to see this whole attitude that we're better than everyone else, him and his manager at Suarez. It's just this cocky attitude that we're seeing in the press conferences, like the way they respond to the questions. It's just very strange, and it's not the way the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world should act. There's a big difference between the way he's acting and the way someone like Floyd Mayweather acts, a huge difference, in fact.
Yeah, and you know, you said it earlier, there are five weight classes in the UFC. Four of them have big title fights coming up, you know, where you could easily see it going either way. You know that the champion is going to be tested, get a tough test from the challenger. Four really huge title fights ahead, already scheduled it for the UFC this late spring and summer. And then we've got the one weight class, middleweight, where it just looks like the champion of the weight class isn't particularly interested in any of the challengers, kind of views all the challengers as beneath him. So it is going to be time for someone from another weight class to step up and to fight Anderson Silva. And I hope we see that Anderson Silva that we saw against guys like Rich Franklin. I hope we see that Anderson Silva again, because that guy's an exciting fighter. And that's really the ultimate takeaway from UFC 97. Anderson Silva did not lose, but I think he lost a lot of respect from fans, and I think that it's very important that the next time we see Anderson Silva in the octagon, it's against somebody who forces him to become the Anderson Silva of old.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one guy out there that I think could get Anderson Silva's blood boiling in the middleweight division right now, and I don't consider him a top middleweight, but I think if you book Anderson Silva against Michael Bisping in the UK, if Bisping gets by Dan Henderson, which is obviously not a foregone conclusion, that could get Anderson Silva going just because he'd be going into enemy territory. But still, I don't think Bisping has much of a chance of defeating Anderson Silva, so it's just one of these dilemmas. Yeah, it looks sexy on paper in promoting the fight, but when you get to the fight, I just don't see it being much of a challenge for him. It's unfortunate. The UFC is in a tough predicament, but really, like you said, four of their other weight classes are about to be occupied by dream matches, so to speak. So, you can't have five amazing weight classes at one time going on. And right now, the 185-pound division is a little bit suffering. But I think that, you know, in 6 months, that could all change. As we all know in MMA, the great thing about this sport, things could change in an instant. And right now, it's just, you know, a dark period for 185. But I think it'll be back sooner rather than later once guys like, you know, Maya and, like I said, Bisping start to work their way back up.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. 185 will be back. I think you're right. I think if the UFC, if Dana White and the Fertittas could just wave a magic wand, what they would love to have happen is Bisping beats Henderson and then Michael Bisping versus Anderson Silva in London for the 185 title, I think would be an insane environment. And one that, like you said, would make Anderson Silva motivated. He would be motivated by that fight. Another one that I think the UFC would love is to see Wanderlei Silva move down to 185 and challenge Anderson Silva. I think that if Wanderlei Silva beats Rich Franklin at UFC 99 in Germany, that's a fight that the UFC would love to see happen. So it's not like this is going to be how we're always talking about the 185-pound class. It's not like we're never going to see another good middleweight title fight. It just has kind of felt like it because these last two have been lackluster. But we'll see good middleweight title fights again, and I hope we see a real good fight from Anderson Silva again sometime soon.
Yeah, actually, count me as one that doesn't want to see Wanderlei fight Anderson yet. I think Anderson would annihilate Wanderlei Silva. I haven't been impressed with Wanderlei since coming to the UFC. I know he had that one great victory over Keith Jardine, but I view Wanderlei a notch below Chuck Liddell right now. I don't see why people aren't asking for him to retire. He's not looking good. So, if he does beat Rich Franklin, I don't expect him to beat Rich Franklin. But if he does, kudos for him. But I still think I don't think that just because you move down and win one big fight, you deserve a title shot. So I think he's actually far away.
Well, I do expect him to beat Rich Franklin. And I agree with you that it's not the type of thing that he hasn't earned a 185 shot over a lot of guys he'd be bypassing, but I think that we're not going to see a boring five-round decision if it's Anderson Silva versus Wanderlei Silva. I can promise you that. And I think that's a factor because of the way that this last fight went. I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss the possibility that Wanderlei Silva fights Anderson Silva for the 185 belt, and I think that would be extremely exciting. But no question about it. I think you and I are on the same page that we just, more than anything else, we want to see somebody who's going to force Anderson Silva to either become the Anderson Silva that we saw a couple of years ago or to lose, to not just win kind of lackluster fights the way he has against Cote and Leitez. I think that's the ultimate takeaway from UFC 97. It's disappointing that that's the ultimate takeaway because there were much better fights than the main event. Shogun looked good. Czech Congo looked good. Luis Kane looked good. Lots of good fights on that card. It's too bad that that's what we're talking about. But hey, that's what's going on in MMA today. And it's been good talking about it with you, Ariel. I was glad to get your perspective, having been there at Cage Side, and I think we're going to have to keep doing more of these MMA podcasts.
Yeah, always a pleasure. It's a great way to start the week. So thanks again for having me, MDS, and always appreciate the great work you do.
Okay, thanks. Same to you, Ariel. And with that, we are out.